Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to the EAN Cast, weekly neurology. My name is Tobias Kronberg, and I'm a professor in neurology at Lund University in southern Sweden. This month's topic in the EAN Cast is neurocritical care. And in today's episode, we will talk about EEG in the neuro ICU. And my guest today is Andrea Rossetti, who is assistant professor and head of the epilepsy EEG unit at Lausanne University Hospital, the CHUV, and Lausanne University in Switzerland. And Andrea is a well-known researcher in the field of epilepsy and cardiac arrest-related neurology, who has done a lot of important research on the use of EEG in intensive care. So welcome, Andrea, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Tobias, for having me and for the introduction.
Thank you. Let's start with a more personal perspective, Andrea, and tell me a little bit about how you got stuck in the field of EEG.
Well, I should say by chance, like many things in life. So I just happened to be in the EEG rotation when I was a resident more than 20 years ago, and then I got the virus doing that. Getting the interest to ICU EEG was, in contrast, more a cognitive step, since at that time, at least in Europe, ICU EEG was more or less a niche as compared to the classical EEG that was made at the time, that was performed at the time, that was mostly devoted to classical epileptology, so epilepsy monitoring unit, pre-surgical, and outpatients with epilepsy. So having that niche and the nice interplay with ICU colleagues just stimulated me, and so it's how it happened.
Just for the listener, Andrea, which time are we talking about? How long ago is this?
Well, it was at the beginning of 2000, so it was 2002 when I just started with EEG. Yeah,
That's almost the same time as when we started doing cooling for cardiac arrest patients in the ICU. And I know that introduction of EEG for the cardiac arrest patients also was boosted a lot about by this new treatment with hypothermia and the great interest for the patients that it brought with it. It was a lot of enthusiasm at that time, wasn't it?
Yes, definitely. And when you get enthusiastic, then you try to sort out different tools and to explore different tools. And possibly, as compared to the period before the hypothermia, the nihilistic observational approach to cardiac arrest patient was getting changed. That time.
Yeah, that's true. A great time for development of different methods, EEG and biomarkers and also imaging for cardiac arrest patients and other ICU, neuro ICU patients. So in your work today, in your clinical work, how do you work with the EEG? Tell me.
So the specificities of Switzerland, which apply to other countries in Europe, but not, for example, to your country, which is Sweden, is that we are part of the neurological department and we do also neurological work. So we see patients with the outpatient, inpatients with epilepsy, with disorders of consciousness. And on top of that, we perform EEGs, for instance, from newborns or premature newborns to elderly people. And among all this activity, there is the ICU EEG activity and then consultant activity, which I supervise on a routinely basis. So it's difficult to say how many EEGs or hours I spend per day, but it's highly variable depending on the flow of patients. Just to give you a practical example, this morning we have two new patients, so we are starting EEGs within 24 hours, and we are also planning, the evoked potentials after 24 hours, control EEG, a follow-up EEG after 48 to 72 hours, and the clinical examination. That's a standard planning that we do upon admittance of the patients. On top of that, we have subarachnoid bleeding patients, we have encephalitis patients, but that's really highly variable.
So in the cardiac arrest patients, because I guess the first two was cardiac arrest.
That's right.
And in those, you would use EEG for prognostication to try to foresee whether the patient will wake up and recover or not. And in the patient with the subarachnoid hemorrhage, how do you use the EEG in that patient?
So we try to use more and more these long-term EEGs to make a surveillance of delayed ischemia. That can go on for several days. And that's another approach, much less looking at, you know, the short-term reactivity, the small transient or the small transitory asymmetry, but more consistent asymmetries over hours to detect this delayed ischemia in the interplay with the ultrasound.
And if you detect a delayed ischemia in such a patient, would that have direct implications for the treatment?
That's right. So we would alarm the caregiving team in the ICU, mostly prompting an ultrasound that's normally done once a day or once every second day, you know, for a spot of maybe 15 minutes. And then an imaging with contrast for the vessels. Mm. And of course, then the neurosurgeons and the vascular specialists would adapt the treatment, like Nimotop, Nimodipine, and vasodilant administrations.
Yeah. And we will come back to that. But does it mean that you keep looking on that? Do you have that EEG in front of you all day, or how do you deal with it during nighttime?
Yeah, that's a good point. So during the day, the working day, we have a compressed EEG facility, commercial compressed EEG, that's displayed over 8 hours or 12 hours. So you see the trends. And yeah, coming back to what I said, it's important not to look at the raw data all the time, but rather to have a spot on the EEG every hour or second hour. And that's easily done, you know, in the reading room. Mm. Overnight, there is no coverage, I have to admit. The ICU colleagues could cover, but it depends on their confidence with the method. So it's highly variable, depending on the team who is in charge during the night. And that's it. And on the weekend, we try to have a couple of spots during the days to look at these trends and have these surveillance.
So in this patient with encephalitis, how do you, which is the purpose of the EEG in that patient?
Well, this is rather a stratified screening at the beginning. You want to see whether the brain is working correctly or not. So let's say to quantify the encephalopathy, so the brain dysfunction, and if you have some abnormalities to further assess if there are irritative, so epileptiform abnormalities or even seizures that can complicate the clinical picture. And of course, this has therapeutic consequence. For encephalitis, we tend to stratify the risk of seizures using spot EEGs, like for cardiac arrest patients. So we don't go automatically to long-term EEG, but that's a local practice, actually.
Mm, right. So the encephalitis patient, you would have spot EEGs, and the cardiac arrest, you would use spot EEGs. But in the patient with subarachnoid hemorrhage, you would use a continuous EEG. Now, I've often been thinking about the organization of EEG experts and EEG interpretations, and comparing different countries. And you told us how you work. In Sweden, we have a clinical neurophysiologist who is an expert in EEG, who makes all the EEG assessments, but who is never really responsible for any patients. He isn't a neurologist. And, and doesn't have outpatient clinics, for example. What do you think about this trade-off, whether to be 100% expert or in the neurophysiology, or to be the combination of neurologists with EEG expertise?
Like everything in life, there are great grades of gray. It's not black and white. So maybe, in my view, the advantages of being in an open country like Sweden would be that the clinical neurophysiologist it's a pure interpreter of the signal without getting a perturbation from the clinical picture. Actually, from a pedagogical point of view, we say that the best reading is performed just by knowing the age and the medication of the patients, nothing more. So you are more neutral. And I think you get to that having your approach. On the other side, having a more comprehensive approach may increase your understanding of the picture and the nuances. But of course, you are less objective, maybe. And so either way, you should try to mitigate the downsides of the approach and try to understand the limits.
Yeah. I mean, for most of us neurologists who are clinical neurologists, EEG is rather mysterious. It's these waveforms, and you see the patterns in these waveforms. And at least in Sweden, we do training in neurophysiology during our education. But it's with time, you tend to forget. And although I've been researching on EEG and I work with EEG experts, I still struggle to do my interpretations and to see what's artifacts, for example, and what's the real patterns. And I wonder if to become an EEG expert, how much training do you need? How long does it take?
Well, that's there is no definite answer. I suppose I can give you the Swiss approach, which is one approach. It's at least 6 months full time or 1 year 50% being exposed to EEG and having at least 500 interpreted tracings, but not especially, you know, ICU rather than pediatric or outpatient. So 500 tracings. And that's the requirement. And then there is an examination, a practical examination. But that's the Swiss approach. Are you then an expert? No, probably not. But you are more or less confident in interpreting most of the EEGs you are exposed to. It's like being an artisan, in my view. You know, a tailor or a jeweler has his or her diploma after, you know, completing the training. Now, if you go to the tailor for a suit, maybe you have a better service if the tailor has some experience of 2, 3, 5, 10 years than if the tailor just came out of training. When is the tailor an excellent tailor? It depends on the particular skills of the tailor, the personality of the tailor, and that's all, you know, to be put into the basket, and it's quite difficult to measure, in my view. To give you a constructive and maybe concise answer, maybe if you see several dozens of ICU tracings with different ages, different etiologies, and different sedations and comorbidities, then you will have some expertise. You know, if you see just 20 tracing of cardiac arrest, you cannot say you're an expert on the ICU EEG.
Right. With the introduction of continuous monitoring in the ICU came also this concept of the EEG as a monitor of brain activity in the comatose patient. And to be a monitor, you need to have some kind of continuous evaluation, and ideally by the bedside crew. And there has been some different studies on that. Is it possible to train the bedside crew to recognize important patterns as status epilepticus, for example? What is your take on that?
Yeah, of course, you're completely right. there is a difference between continuous recording and continuous monitoring, and you are pointing to the spot. And definitely, there has been some literature on that, and I completely agree. It's definitely possible to train non-neurophysiologists to recognize patterns, also to recognize these compressed EEGs. In my view, the training should aim at stratifying the risk. So this is a high-risk pattern, and then I set the alarm, and then I see what I can do. It's an illusion to have a 2 hours training or a 6 hours training and pretend that somebody is an expert on NEG. I give you just an example. Looking at road traces, one of the quote mistakes we see quite often in ICU patients is when physiological sleep patterns arise that are sharp, that are at times periodic or rhythmic, and they are taken for epilepsy features. And of course, if you just look at ICU EEGs, you very rarely see physiological sleep, but then you need a more comprehensive knowledge. On the contrary, to be able to sort out these rhythmic periodic patterns and with the frequency that is correlated to the risk of seizure, that's clearly doable, and you need the just dedicated persons on the ICU side to have a consequent monitoring of the patient.
Hmm. Now the AI technologies is the talk of the town in almost every field that we do research. How does AI come into play in EEG interpretation?
Well, it's a hot spot. Both of we are aware that there are current studies on that. Some are already published, and they are extremely promising, especially in for the time being. AI is apparently very performant in sorting out normal tracings, in outpatients or inpatients. That's a good start. There are current studies to look at, more abnormal tracings, and that's more tricky, but I'm very confident that AI will be quite performant at a given time. It's important to have some reflections on that, some thoughts. The first one is that there are several groups working on that, automatic EEG reading and AI, and each group has its own approach. And that's a problem when you want to generalize and, in a way, commercially spread an approach that has to be, acknowledged by the people doing the work in the practice. So generalization is an issue still now. And on the other side is availability. If you have just 3 centers worldwide that use that, well, it's fine, but it's not a game changer. So you have to make affordable tools that are generally available and accepted by the community. And that's going to be some years, I think. But is the direction, so the way is already paved.
Hmm. Like it's starting also, for example, in imaging.
Definitely.
With AI interpretations. And I was thinking about these critical care EEG monitoring. Has there been any studies on that with the simplified EEG in the critical care?
There are several studies with the critical care, once again, from different groups using different approaches. And they are quite promising. But of course, then I'm repeating myself, the obstacle is having something that it's recognized by everybody. And of course, there are particular interests that have to be put aside. So working together and trying to do one way is going to be more efficient, probably. It's a question of time.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Maybe something for the neurophysiological societies to work together with.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. And we'll switch over a little bit to this discussion about, with critical care EEG, there is a discussion whether to use simplified EEG or to use a full EEG. And could you tell us a bit more about that difference
Yeah, your center is one of the most important worldwide. With the experience of simplified energy with four electrodes, you have been showing over several years that that's very performant in prognosticating, for instance, post-cardiac arrest patient, where the damage is more or less global.
Mm.
If you have a more local damage, then the consensus is to have a denser array of electrodes and montage. So maybe you should look at the indications and once again stratify the optimal number of electrodes, I think.
Because it's also about increasing the availability. If you have a simplified montage that the ICU nurse could apply, you get the EEG monitoring started already in the evening or during the night shift, and you have some information already in the morning when the expert is coming into office, I assume.
That's right. So the downside is that if you start at 10 p.m. and then you read at 8 a.m., it's 10 hours later. Does it really help? So there are not really good studies on that. It's more an illusion to have, in my sense. Just the recording is fine, and then you don't know. It's like, you know, an intensivist having the EKG but not looking at it and looking at it after 10 hours.
Mm.
Nobody would do that.
I agree. That's the controversy between registering EEG or monitoring EEG.
That's it. Mm. On the other side, you know, well, putting four electrodes or 21 electrodes, does it make a big difference in time? If you have a skilled technologist, not really. It takes maybe, I don't know, 4 minutes to put the four electrodes and 10 minutes to put the 21 electrodes in a skilled hand. And that's not really at stake, I think. Looking at the EEG is probably easier, definitely easier with two leads as compared to 20 leads. But if you have a trained eye, it's not a big difference either. Storage, of course, it's much less with two leads. And storage also money, of course. So you have all these trade-offs.
Mm. Yeah. Now, you did a study comparing spot EEG with continuous EEG monitoring. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
That study was a randomized study looking at the clinical impact on outcome at 6 months of performing two repeated spot EEGs of 20, 30 minutes within 48 hours versus a continuous EEG lasting at least 30 hours in ICU patients needing EEGs. Of note, we excluded patients that had shortly seizure or status epilepticus, since there is a common indication and consensus to monitor these patients. So it would have not have been ethical to include them. So in patients with just suspected seizure or encephalopathy, it was shown that randomizing these patients was no difference between the continuous and the spot EEGs repeated in terms of outcome, mortality, and functional outcome, which is quite interesting. It's about 350 patients that were randomized. It's quite interesting and counterintuitive. And why was that? Probably because actually EEG and electricity in the brain is only one of the actors of outcome. And outcome is also determined by the biological background, structural damage, co-medication toxicity, infections, and so on. And you don't have a hand on that just with the electricity. So if you, let's say, treat the electrical discharges in a patient that had a massive brain trauma, I mean, you can get rid of the spikes, but the brain is not doing fine because of that. And there is an illusion at times in people that are not so familiar with the field that treating efficiently each spike is going to save all patients. That's not the case. And that gives us some humbler approach and humility to understand where we should put our energy to monitor the patient. So not everybody, probably.
Thank you, Andrea. I think that's an important take-home message, that with the continuous monitoring, you find a lot of epileptic activity, and you tend to treat a lot of epileptic activity. But in a large group of patients, it didn't lead to a better outcome. And maybe we should be a little bit more restrictive and thoughtful about what we do treat and don't. So thank you very much, Andrea Rossetti, for sharing all your thoughts with us around continuous EEG monitoring and spot EEG in the critical care setting. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It was my pleasure, Tobias. Many, many thanks again, and have a great day.
This has been EANcast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.